with Jenna Ellis. This is the show where we answer all of your pressing questions and issues on demand. And today we are going to be doing a deep dive into the issue of federalism. What is it? Can America return to it? What was our original plan? And Rich from Texas had a great question on this, and he emailed in and said this, Jenna, I'm very concerned about the 2024 election, as we all are, Rich. And I am just wondering, with all of the great Republican governors out there, you usually mention Governor Ron DeSantis and the great work that he does in Florida. Why can't the states just say no if Kamala Harris wins? So that's a great question, Rich. And to answer that question and to discuss further, joining me now is my good friend Mike Donnelly, who is an opinionated constitutionalist, so perfect for this issue, self-described that way, and also a law professor and attorney, and has been a mentor of mine for, it's probably been over a decade now, I guess, Mike. And, you know, you're always one that I call and I'm like, and I say, am I thinking, you know, conservatively and biblically on this issue? And, you know, We talk through it as lawyers do, which is a lot of fun. So I love this format where we get to just talk through things. So welcome to On Demand.
Thanks, Jenna. It's been great over the years to get to talk about these issues with you, and it's been so much fun. And it's never been more important for us to have this conversation about federalism, the role of the federal government, the role of the states. We have become unmoored from our constitutional foundation. And the only way, in my opinion, that it is going to be restored is if the states take action. So I'm eager to have a conversation about Rich's question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could not agree more. And what we've seen, you know, over America's history, and increasingly so in the 20th century, and then, of course, you know, now we're almost 25 years in to the 21st century, is this erosion of our original system of government and a concentrated federal government with overreaching power and authority. And basically all of these entitlements back to the states, and that, you know, they come with different strings attached, that have attempted to neuter the effectiveness of states and their ability to limit the federal government and actually demand that the federal government represent the states and the state legislature. So let's kind of start there with the original purpose of federalism and a good working definition.
Well, yeah, sure. So, I mean, the concept of federalism was to balance the power of the sovereign state. You know, we had been under the sovereign authority of the King of England, with the colonies having charters, but everything treed up to the king. And, you know, there were philosophers at the time, Montesquieu and Locke, who were talking about things, the rule of law, religious freedom, balance of power, separation of powers, and this was kind of a new idea. And our founders were reading these ideas, and they were looking to implement them. And, you know, the idea of federalism also, it's very interesting. Mike Lee wrote a great book, two great books on the Constitution and our founders, which I highly recommend people to read. And he traces in one of his chapters on Ben Franklin this idea of federalism here in the United States back to the Iroquois nation. Fascinating. And, you know, some people say that Ben Franklin got the idea of this kind of federalism from the Iroquois, who had these different peoples, but they were all united, even though they all had separate powers. You had different tribes, but there was the Iroquois nation. And, you know, the Mike Lee researches this in this book, and he says, you know, this is where Ben Franklin got this idea, and he brought it to the Constitutional Convention. Kind of cool, kind of interesting. You know, Native Americans, you know, the first peoples, if you want to talk about it, having an influence on, you know, the design of our country. But the whole idea
Indigenous Peoples
that,
Day, you know that we just recently celebrated. So, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I missed you. Say that again.
I just said Indigenous Peoples Day that we just recently celebrated, you know. Yeah. So.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah, that's
right.
Indigenous Peoples Day. I mean, I think nothing wrong with calling it Columbus Day. Okay. I think that's fine. But anyway, yeah. Whatever. So the founders have all these ideas, and we had the Articles of Confederation, which was, you know, a confederation, and, you know, the founders thought it wasn't working well, so they decided to make a change. Had the Constitutional Convention, and they came up with the Constitution. And again, you know, they tried to put these ideas, and they said, we need something more of a little bit more of a national government. The Articles of Confederation was basically every state got a vote, and everything had to be done by unanimous consent. And it was difficult because they would never agree. And, you know, so they said, we need something to represent the country. especially to foreign nations, and we got to have a military so we can defend ourselves and other things. So they came up with these ideas. And separation of powers is a little bit different, but I think it fits into this conversation because you've got the three branches, you know, the coordinate branches. I'm going to say coordinate, Jenna. You know why? People today like to use the word co-equal, but the founders never used that word, and they didn't intend for the branches to be co-equal. They called them coordinate. We can have a conversation about that later if you want. But you've got the three coordinate branches of government, but the states were, are, and were intended to be sovereign entities. And so the states are like, no way, we're not giving up all our power. And so this idea of federalism, dual federalism, is how I would teach my constitutional law students about it. You have the state, the national government, federal government, that has specific and enumerated powers given to it under the Constitution, specific and enumerated, right? And then the states are, you know, Ninth and Tenth Amendment basically say, look, we got everything else. And in the Constitution, you've got some powers that kind of overlap. But the idea of federalism is that we're going to divide up the power so that no government becomes too powerful and encroach on our freedoms, because the founders, you know, had enough of that.
Yeah, and I think that dual federalism is a great way to describe this, and how the Constitution was originally set up and then ultimately ratified was specific limited enumerated powers for the federal government that were and limited means limited. And so when we have a national legislature, it's not that they just had power to create law on any topic or subject matter that they thought was in the best interest. I mean, and so this is where the General Welfare Clause, of course, has gotten completely bastardized and, you know, totally out of context. But it has, we need to go back to the original understanding of Article 1, Section 8, and saying, you know, these are only the subject matter that the entire union, a federal government, properly should deal with. Like, for example, a uniform rule of immigration and naturalization, where it wouldn't make sense if California and Texas had two very different views on immigration and enforcement. And that's kind of what we're seeing actually right now, unfortunately. Some states effectively secure their borders, and other states, or at least trying to, like Texas and Florida, and other states like California just don't even care. And that actually ends up affecting the rest of the states in the union. So, you know, so the federal government does serve a purpose, but that doesn't mean that the federal government can impose its will on any issue for the states on things that no power is given to the federal Congress or the executive, or especially the judiciary, to either for the first branch to create law, for the second to enforce it, or for the third to, you know, arbitrarily make law from the bench in terms of judicial activism, but even opine and to have those opinions be controlling on all of the states. So with that original model, Mike Donnelly, where did we start to get off of that, and where the states just basically said, sure, we're fine with letting the feds do everything?
Well, that's a long history, and I would point to a few things. I think it started, I think you have to go back to the Civil War to understand where the federal government got a lot of its power from. I mean, you know, to the victor go the spoils, right? And not saying that the outcome of freeing slaves was incorrect, that's the right outcome. I mean, frankly, if we go back to the beginning, it was a moral compromise, which I don't agree with, in the beginning, where, you know, the Congress, when it had the power to stop slavery, didn't do it when it could have earlier in the early 1800s. But at that point, you know, the federal government had a lot of power and it was doing a lot of things. And then, you know, you've got two generations past the Civil War, to where I would point to 1913, and where our predecessors decided they wanted to have a Federal Reserve Bank, a central banking system, okay, which, you know, we can unpack what was going on in the banking system at that time. States had their own banks, and there was different state currencies, and not saying that we didn't need to unify, but that was one thing. The second thing was the income tax, and to me, this is the real pernicious thing that has allowed the federal government to become what it was never intended to become. Because, you know, as the Bible says, money, you know, right, is at the root of evil, right? And when the federal government can stick its hands in our pockets anytime it wants to and take as much out whenever it wants to and spend it however it wants to, which the Supreme Court has allowed it to do incorrectly, as you pointed out before, in my opinion, interpreting the general welfare clause to allow the Congress to spend money on things that the Constitution never gave the power to spend money on. But when it has been enabled and allowed to do that over 100-some years, that to me explains why we're in the situation we are. You know, and that's why we have a $35 trillion debt, and you know, which is putting, which is going to put so much pressure on future generations. You know, Jenna, you know, I've got a grandson. He's 2 years old. I've got seven children. You know, I'm really concerned about what this country is going to be like for them, for their grandkids, for my great-grandkids, if we don't get this money problem under control. And so to me, that, you know, and then the other thing, of course, is the 17th Amendment, which basically cut the states out of the picture. The 17th Amendment allowed for the popular election of senators. Up until that point, the state legislatures had appointed, based on different rules in each state, they could decide for themselves how they wanted to appoint senators. But they were the ones who appointed the senators. And up until that point, the senators really did represent the states as states. And when that changed, you know, no longer did the senators represent the state as a state, but they really just became super congressmen. And all the things that go into that, which is pandering to the population and, you know, direct election by the population. And I think those were two things that were probably, you know, the people who passed those amendments and came up with them, they intended good things. There were problems. There were issues with in the state governments with, you know, conflict over how to appoint senators. And sometimes there were deadlocks and they wouldn't send a senator. And so one state might have one senator, or, you know, there would be difficulty in communicating between the state legislature. And then they would pull a senator out because they didn't like the senator. And then they'd put a new one in. So I'm not saying there weren't issues that people wanted to try to solve, but those two amendments, I believe, have resulted in a complete imbalance of the system that we had given to us by the founders structurally. You talk about structural issues. Those are two structural issues that have caused the massive federal government that we have. The states don't have a voice as states, and the federal Congress, the government, can take as much money as it wants and spend it on whatever it wants. And the founders saw that could happen. And that's why they didn't give the federal government the authority to tax income. That's why they put in state legislatures appointing senators. And if we're going to go back and fix this, I think we need to look at those two amendments.
I agree. And we've talked, for those who listen to the morning show regularly, you know, we've talked, at least touched on, you know, some of these same issues in terms of the 16th and 17th Amendments. And both, interestingly, were ratified in 1913. So, you know, this is kind of a little after the turn of the century. But, you know, this was going more into the first Industrial Revolution, you know, some of those things that came about. And what we've seen in terms of the last 100 years of the problems and how that has facilitated a massive overreach. And, you know, you talk about spending, Mike. I mean, you and, you know, Thomas Massey and others who were so concerned about the out of control spending. I mean, it's not even that, okay, the taxation rate is insane. And I agree with those who say this kind of taxation is theft. I mean, we know from scripture that we should pay our taxes, contribute to a well-ordered government. I'm happy that if I call 911 with an emergency, somebody will show up. I'm happy for first responders. I mean, there are things that the government, but, you know, but that's state and local, right, that they spend money on that we actually need. But for the federal government to have no real accountability and go way beyond even their massive take from the people and to put us so far into debt that it's just utterly insane. I mean, there was a stat that said that each American citizen now, if you divvied up our entire sum, it was something, you know, like $200,000 a person, which is probably even greater than that since I read that stat. I mean, that's just insane. And Barry Goldwater said it even in the early 80s in a book that he wrote, saying, you know, this is not the conservative position, and how Republicans in the federal government are ceding their position on conservatism to say that they can just take and then spend on anything without the people's consent. I mean, you know, you think even with the 17th Amendment and having popular election of senators, are they really accountable to the people? Not in the same way as they were to state legislatures. I mean, even with the problems of, you know, recalling and then putting in somebody else and some of those things, at least they were more directly accountable to represent the state interests. Now it's like, you know, nobody even knows what bills are being passed unless, you know, media draws attention to it, and largely conservative media only cares if it's a hot button political issue or social issue. I mean, so much of this spending, it's not just about, you know, Ukraine or, you know, funding some of the, you know, the wars in the Middle East and that kind of thing. But this is about massive spending that's been out of control for, you know, for more than 100 years now. And so when we're talking about going back to federalism, I mean, a good first start would be repealing both of these amendments. And I'm interested, just as a side tangent, since we can do that on this long format, Trump has said, mm-hmm. you know, if he gets a second term, that he is in favor of most of the federal revenue, like basically getting rid of income tax, which I don't think will actually happen because of how big the lobby is for, you know, even accounting firms and all of that stuff. But even if we were able to do that, and he wants more of the federal revenue to come from tariffs rather than income taxes, I mean, that's what we had prior to the early 20th century. Is it possible that with an executive administration that is focused on doing that, is that a potential option even with the 16th Amendment currently?
Well, Congress would have to act to change the amount of money coming into the IRS via the income tax. You know, the executive branch, you know, cannot do that on his own. So all the tariffs as well also have to go through Congress. So, you know, I appreciate where Donald Trump is coming from. I'm, you know, as an economist myself, you know, I believe that a trading system that has less friction is going to be good for everybody. But I do understand the frustration. You know, when other countries are being unfair and mistreating the United States in terms of trade. So I really appreciate what Donald Trump is saying about how we need to make sure we're driving good trade deals. But he's going to have to use, you know, Congress is going to have to get on board with that, which is why it's so important, in my opinion, to get Republicans into Congress. Of course, you know, just because we get Republicans in Congress doesn't mean we're going to get these great reforms. I mean, that's the thing, is I look at the Congress, I look at the federal government, and I say that is not where you know, the country is going to be rescued. And I wanted to turn back to this conversation we're having about the founders. They saw this happening. James Madison wrote in Federalist Number 47, here's what he said about tyranny. Okay, yes, the word tyranny, capital T, right? He said, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. And so, you know, I have said that I believe that we are living under a federal tyranny. Why? Because I believe that the accumulation of power in the federal government, in the legislative, executive, judicial branches, has reached that level of control. And when you talk about spending money, that's control, okay? And that's how the federal government exerts control, through spending on general welfare, Medicare, education, Social Security, okay? These are all federal programs. They take the money from everybody, they put it in the pot, and they create these programs that have all these rules and regulations, and a lot of it is behavioral, right? So education rules and regulations, a lot of it comes from the Federal Department of Education. A lot of it's not good right now, right? But that's through spending programs, okay, which the Supreme Court in 1936 in what was the case, U.S. v. Butler, basically said that the Congress can spend for the general welfare under the Constitution, pretty much blowing up the guardrails that the founders had put in there with the specific and enumerated powers. So, again, you've got the Supreme Court enabling the Congress, enabling the executive branch to pretty much do whatever it wants. I mean, we just had the Chevron case overturned, which was good. So I see a couple of things happening. You know, Trump's talking about it. We got some people in Congress talking about it. You see the Supreme Court doing a few things. So I see people sort of nodding their head at the federal government level towards federalism and doing some things to roll back some of the things that have happened that have allowed the federal government to establish this, what I'll call a federal tyranny. Okay. I mean, yeah, we're not living, you know, yes, we're not being rounded up by, you know, the feds, at least I'm not. Some people may be. I mean, I guess Steve Bannon just got out of prison, so he was rounded up and there were other people. So we've got problems. We've got problems with the federal government doing tyrannical things. And so we really need to do something about this. And a lot of it comes back to the money. So I would like to focus people on the money. And if we can do something about the income tax, if we can, yes, we can cut taxes. We need to make the Trump tax cuts permanent. But the whole income tax idea was never part of the original founding for good reason. And we see why now. And I feel like we really need to think about this. We need to get people who are economists and judicial, you know, legal thinkers like us talking about this and figuring out a way that we can do this. And there's a thing out there, Jenny, you probably heard about the fair tax, which would repeal the 16th Amendment and put in place a national sales tax, which to me would be a constitutional form of taxation. We're not going to be able to go from 100% of our current government budget to 10% overnight, but we really need to start making some progress if we're going to save this country.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And, you know, money is power. And so it's not just about the subject matter and the legislation and, you know, all of those things. It really is about the overspending. And so when we're talking about more of a return to federalism and some of these states that would want to, let's say in the eventuality that you have a Kamala Harris administration, some of these red states and conservative states that say, you know, we don't want to support what Kamala Harris is spending money on and all of those things. Where are the parameters, I guess, and then also, you know, just in where are we at now in 2024, where a governor of a state or even a state legislature could stand up on behalf of their state and just say no?
Yeah, I think this is exactly what governors need to be doing. Ron DeSantis and Patrick Morrisey, who's going to become the governor in my state of West Virginia, who has really stood up to the federal government. He was responsible for the EPA, you know, the Biden case, which was really important case, and others, and they're doing that to a degree. But my goodness, the amount of money though that's coming into the states from the federal government, you know, you can understand why it's hard to say no to it. Billions and billions and billions of dollars. But there have been some states, 15 states, from what I understand, declined participation in some programs. You know, these are still small programs. You know, for example, 23 and 24, the federal summer food assistance program that provides EBT funds to some families during the summer months. They said, we're not going to get involved with that. We will provide our own assistance to these people because these came with certain rules that they didn't want to follow. Florida declined $320 million that were intended to reduce vehicle emissions, saying, you know, we're not going to impose federal climate policies on state infrastructure. So these are exactly the kinds of decisions that governors need to do. They're hard decisions because that's a lot of money to say no to. But I think that Republican governors need to think very seriously about protecting their states from being dependent on federal money. Because, you know, Jenna, the national government has $35 trillion in debt. Okay, and a lot of those bills of debt are from Americans. But most state governments don't have that level of debt. And, you know, I would hate to see the federal government default on its debt. But I think this is a conversation we cannot avoid having. How can we continue to, you know, see debt rising at the levels that it is rising and nobody does anything about it? They're not doing anything about it. They just keep spending. And are the Republicans, even if the Republicans take over the Congress with 55 or 54 or 53 Republicans, you know, what are they going to do about it? Like, I don't hear them talking about it. I don't hear anybody with a plan. You know, I watched Donald Trump's Madison Square Garden event. And I was so enthusiastic to see Elon Musk up there. And he was asked the question, Elon, how much can we get out of the federal government budget? You know, Biden's budget is $6.5 trillion. And he said, we'll take $2 trillion out. I'm like, well, that's great. That's only one third. Does that balance the budget? Like, that's what we need to do. We need to balance the budget and we need to stop spending. And there's just no incentives in Washington, D.C. for them to stop spending because there are no they're not being held accountable. You know, they can just do it because the Federal Reserve is willing to buy the money. And then inflation occurs and everybody's like, why are prices going up? And because, you know, the American people haven't been educated, unfortunately, through our education system to understand what inflation even is. So we've got a lot of problems. We keep talking about these things. And the people who are listening to us right now need to be talking to their friends about it. And we've all got to educate our fellow citizens about what the cause of the problem is and what we can do to fix it. And as I've said, in my view, we've got to focus on the money.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're so right that it really does come down to education. And I know for students that have gone through, you know, your constitutional law class, you know, people at my church who have gone through my Wednesday night class over the course of this semester, that's just, you know, a basic civics instruction on our system and all of that, you know, have said, wow, there's so much more to this than just kind of the top level that you get from mainstream media about the issues. And, you know, it really comes down to, and you know, you and I both learned this, of course, in law school, that if you know the rules, you will be a much more effective advocate because you can't just have passion for an issue and, you know, go to the rule maker or the arbiter and say, you know, hey, this is my position. They're going to say, well, what authority do I have? And, you know, will I win? And all of those other things. And so if we just say to the federal government, well, you know, stop taxing us so much or have these certain policy positions, we have to understand what the system was originally designed to do, how it has gotten manipulated and coerced, and then how we have common sense rollbacks. And even if we start, I mean, yeah, a third of the federal budget, I mean, that's not as much as it should be, but that's much better than a potential Harris administration would increase it to. And even Donald Trump's first term, I mean, he increased the federal deficit by a lot. And people, you know, conservatives don't want to talk about that. But the people in Washington, to your point, Mike, they don't care and are not going to talk about that issue, even Republicans, because we no longer are fiscally conservative. That's why you only have a few of the lone voices like a Thomas Massie who is willing to talk about that and call attention to it. And so in just the last few minutes I have with you on this topic, I mean, yes, spending is out of control. We need to reform that system. And there are ways for sure that governors of states can stand up on these issues like border security, for example. I mean, Article 1, Section 10 says you can declare an invasion, you can protect your border. You can do things like what Governor DeSantis has done by saying, you know, no, we're going to outlaw central bank digital currency in our Uniform Commercial Code and say, no, the federal government cannot transact, you know, business under that because we want to protect our citizens' wealth. I mean, there are these things that we can do. And so by and large, if this is the ultimate conservative goal to return to a federalist model, why aren't more Republican governors doing it?
I think it's because they don't know, one, that they can do it, and two, nobody's telling them that they should do it. There aren't enough people saying, let's, you know, we've got to look after our citizens. We cannot become dependent on the federal government. Like Ron DeSantis is a great leader in this area. I mean, you know, he's a great example of gubernatorial leadership, saying no to money from the federal government. You know, when the hurricanes came through, he took charge and was the executive that everybody expected him to be, and, you know, wasn't waiting for the federal government to come in, not saying that in North Carolina, although North Carolina, you know, you got a Democrat governor there, what were they waiting for, you know? So I think that's, you know, they need to talk about it. I'd love to see Ron DeSantis convene the federal, the other Republican governors, and frankly, some Democrats, if they want to come and listen, and say, guys, you know, we cannot look to the federal government to save us. Their profligate spending is going to have a big impact on us at some point. You know, the chickens are going to come home to roost, as somebody said once upon a time. And that's what we're looking at with $35 trillion worth of debt. And the only authorities that we can look to other than the federal government to get to protect us from that is our state governments. And that's why we need to elect conservatives into state government to begin preparing for that day when there's going to be, and I don't know if it's going to happen quickly, catastrophically, or if it's just going to happen over a period of time and just be a slow degradation, a continuing degradation in our economy. But that's going to happen if we don't get the federal house in order. The states need to be there and be prepared to pick up the pieces if something catastrophic does happen. You know, the Bible says, Jen, in Proverbs 22:7, the borrower is slave to the lender. Okay, the federal government is $35 trillion in debt. And, you know, so they're the slave. Who's the lender? Well, it's mostly us. So we're basically enslaving ourselves. And that's what's going on.
Isn't that a cautionary tale that biblical principles matter for governments who act legitimately and even within a framework, whether it's a constitutional republic or some other form of government, we always need to adhere to biblical principles. And one of the silver linings, hopefully, of, you know, you're talking about the Republican Governors Association, one of the silver linings of Governor Ron DeSantis staying in Florida for another 2 years of his term of governor is that he is a leader in the RGA, and I think will continue to be and hopefully have that same call to action to other Republican governors. And, you know, regardless of what happens in this next election, if they get to work with Donald Trump or if they have to oppose a lot of what a Kamala Harris administration would do, we need to have a return to federalism. And so I appreciate this just opening conversation about federalism. These are, you know, a good history, more in depth, but, you know, of course, you and I could spend hours and hours talking about this, Mike Donnelly, but I hope that this gets listeners at least an understanding in more of a deep dive of why federalism matters, why understanding our rules matter, and advocating for a biblical worldview within our structure and keeping a sound constitution. That's our structure. A good constitution absolutely matters. So, Mike Donnelly, thanks so much for joining me today on Demand.
Great being with you, Jenna, and God bless you and everybody listening.
Thanks so much. And for those who want to write in questions, if you have an issue or a topic that you would like for us to cover on Demand, you can always reach me and my team at Jenna at AFR.net. And we will see you here on Demand next Friday.